Aaron Slomsky-Pritz and Jenny Lesser-Holman created the installation Dream Motif in 2023 for the Jack Straw New Media Gallery. I sat down with Jenny and Aaron in the Jack Straw studio to talk about the painted furniture in their installation and how it connects to the interviews they recorded about people's dreams. Jenny Lesser-Holman started us off by describing what it's like to be in the exhibit.
So you enter the room and it's this fabulous high ceiling, totally dark, black walls. And on the far side of the gallery, there's a projection and there are these weird animations that I did that are kind of a mix of animals and shapes and bright colors that get abstracted and kaleidoscoped and variations on a theme. And then there are some pieces of furniture that you can sit on, and the furniture has been painted to evoke dreamscapes and to really allow someone to have the experience of sitting within a dream or a nightmare. So there's a chaise lounge and a chair, and then there are these phones, these rotary phones, that Aaron will go into more detail about. And then I have two painted foam panels in the background that are definitely more of like a secondary thing within the exhibit, but just kind of add to the ambiance.
What you might hear if you were in the room, one voice sharing the context around a dream. So someone, and I guess taking a step back, when I reached out to people to share dreams, that's a particular kind of dream that I was interested in hearing about. It was a dream that has some sort of correspondence to waking life, like a synchronicity is what Carl Jung calls that. And so, you know, I had people share their dreams, but I conducted long interviews with people about the context of the dreams. Often, some of them, and there's a whole range, some of them are really trivial. Like there's a dream about, someone dreams about a podcast, and it's a visual dream, and then the next day is listening to podcasts and like Googles the podcast and realizes that the guest is the person he dreamed about. Anyway, just like, so it's mundane stuff. And then there's some more significant things. A lot of people shared experiences of visitations from people who have been close to them, family members, friends who have died, who came to them in dreams at significant moments. And then there's some sort of correspondence in waking life. So in the gallery, you'll hear mostly people talking about the context around the dreams. And right before they're about to share a dream, a phone rings. There are a number of phones around the room. And you pick up the phone and you'll hear the actual dreams in the phones.
In the beginning of the dream, I was outside on a porch of a big suburban house that I didn't recognize.
Occasionally, the audio in the phones will line up with the audio in the space, like the narration. And that's sort of to sort of represent this question that I had, which is like, where is the dream coming from? Is it in your head? Is it in the space? What is a dream? Are we in a waking dream? Like, where does it end? And it gets really blurry there. So that's a part of it. And then, as Jenny mentioned, there was also music. And different musicians received just the dreams out of context and created leitmotifs or themes to go along with the dreams. And some musicians created whole pieces. There was a pretty wide range. But underneath the narration, there's music, a lot of which is edited and corresponds with different themes that come up in the narration. And then I guess the last thing you'll hear in the space is some field recordings that I took over the time of making this. And there's that was kind of fun. They feel like little hidden, like, a lot of times there'll be something that corresponds to, you know, something someone's talking about. Like someone's talking about a family, and I have audio of my family. Jenny and I also did went on a trip with some friends to Tenasket, Washington, and there's some field recordings from that time in there as well. So yeah, that's sort of, and it kind of all feels very, I guess, ethereal, and I've been told that it feels like, it has a feeling of being in a dream.
Going out and interviewing people about their dreams, where did the inspiration come for this project?
Yeah, so during the pandemic, I on a whim started doing a program that's been turned into a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. And it was through that book, which is really a book about unblocking creativity. It's this idea that everyone is an artist, like life is a creative act. We're all here because of creation. And if we want to create, we just kind of have to get out of our own ways. She offers different practices to just sort of like tap into how you want to be creative. One of those practices is a practice called the morning pages, where you write 3 pages of stream of consciousness writing. It can be anything. It can be like, I don't like writing. This sucks. And you just kind of like let yourself write, knowing that no one's going to see it and it's not for anything. And it was in that time and in that practice in particular that I sort of started seeing a correspondence between what I was writing about and what was coming up in the world. And she says this in the book, and I was really skeptical. She says, you know, like, once you start doing these practices, pay attention to, like, what you might see. Like, maybe if you, like, always wanted to be a dancer and you write about that, just, like, notice if you're, like, in a context where you get an opportunity to do that. So some of these things started happening, and some of them sort of started happening in the dream realm. And I think my background is working in audio journalism, and I think I'm much more comfortable asking people about their experiences. And so I think I was just curious. I wanted to understand a little bit more, like, do other people have these experiences? How do people make sense of them? But to not do it in a journalistic way. To have there be like a visual component and a way of not trying to actually find an answer, but just sort of looking at what was coming up from different angles.
How many people did you interview? What was the interviewing process like?
There are 10 interviews that made it into Dream Motif. Not all the interviews made it in for various reasons. In my training, interviewing, well, it's cool. Like, I see what you have across from me. You have a notebook. You've done your research. You've prepared. A lot of what I had learned how to do and had practiced doing previously was going into a particular situation with someone and sort of knowing what I wanted from them. And I respect the craft of interviewing and that particular kind of interviewing, because it is focused and you can get amazing results. So, like, I think I've heard Ira Glass talk about, you know, for a particular story, like imagining, like, oh, maybe there's like a person who like works in food service who is new to a city, and then you like sort of you find that person and they fit whatever you're working on, and it can make stories and it can make pieces really powerful. I think the other side of it, though, is it can feel sort of manipulative or extractive. And I think for this particular project, I did the opposite of what I had learned, which is that I did no preparing intentionally for every conversation. I never asked. I didn't do pre-interviews. I didn't ask people to share stuff before. And really just tried to listen. And these are some of my favorite interviews or conversations I think I've ever done. So that was sort of the process. And I also made it clear to everyone I interviewed that they could take back whatever they said at any point, even if it was after the installation was up and running. And they just said, like, they could call me and say, I don't want my voice in this anymore, or I don't want this particular piece. And I would honor that. That was really important to have consent sort of being an ongoing part of this, which is also different from a journalistic context, which is that, like, once it's on the record, it's sort of on the record. For the most part, there's some nuance there. And even the night before, I had someone who reached out to me and said, like, I've been thinking about this one part. someone reached out and asked to have part of their interview removed, and did that, and that felt really good.
In the beginning of the dream, I was outside on a porch of a big suburban house that I didn't recognize. And my grandma is there and just reaches out and grabs me by the elbow. And it felt very urgent, and it felt not good, I mean, from the beginning. And we had a conversation. We ended our conversation on this brick promontory by the ocean, and the ocean was very green and very rough. And at the end of this promontory was this big arch, and in the center of the arch was a statue of a woman with her arms raised, and on the side were a couple women in the stone, and the waves were crashing around the brick and on the brick, and I was really scared because we were standing so close to the edge and so close to the statue. I can't swim, and in my dream I was still scared, and she was telling me something and holding my arm.
In the installation, there's audio of the interviews playing, and then the interview will stop, and then the phone will ring, and then you'll pick it up, and the interview will continue. How did the idea for the phone come about?
It might sound strange to say, but I really, and I was just saying this to Jenny right before we came here, there was a way that like different parts of the process would just like reveal themselves. Like, you know, I was telling Jenny, like working on one dream, as I was getting to the end of that, there would be some sort of insight like, oh, this other dream is going to fit with this one. And I think in a similar way, just the phone idea kind of emerged as I was sitting with the question of like, how do I respect the intimacy of what people are sharing and really honor it and really try to work against any kind of extractive model. And I was conducting the interviews remote. A lot of them were remote and people were already recording into their phones. It's like just a more affordable way to get pretty good audio than having like a tape sync or doing it in a studio. And then there was a This American Life piece from a couple years ago where the feature was a phone booth in Japan. I think it's called a wind phone, where people go and like leave messages for the dead. They just like pick it up and they'll talk to them. And so I think it was like sort of in the swirling of all of that, that, it just made sense. It like fit with the kind of interviewing, and it fit. It was a way to like honor the dreams. And also Jenny, I think from the very beginning, was pointing to the possibilities of making it interactive. And I think that became, there was a question of how do we make this engaging? And if it's in a space. And so it sort of like fit all of those things.
Yeah, it was very important to me to not do something boring. I think often art, you know, if you're not like versed in exactly the kind of artists that the artist is referring to, you know, so much of modern art is so self-referential and like it would require a degree and like being in that person's mind to actually know what it is. I don't like that. You know, I think it's better to have it be something you can just engage in.
Both are writers. When you write something for many people to see, you go through many drafts and you edit a lot. What was the editing process for Dream Motif? Did any challenges come up?
I would say I don't know that I'm a writer. I like that idea, but I do more visual stuff, and I do comics. So I guess comics are kind of like there's some writing involved. But I luckily didn't have to do much writing. I find writing very challenging, as opposed to painting, which is just feels great. So I didn't have to do very much, except for our sign, the artist statement.
The editing for this was incredibly, incredibly challenging. And at times, it feels like it makes so much sense now, like listening to it. It's like, oh, yeah, it all fits. But you know, I think as Jenny said, this sort of began as like a, like, maybe we'll make something about dreams. And then everything sort of emerged. And, you know, you have all this material to work with. How do you put it together? And I started over many times. I was swapping things out, like, at 4 a.m, like, every day leading up to the installation. I think I, you know, you can never sort of, there's a way, it's kind of obvious, but you can never stop working on something. Sometimes you just have to get to a deadline. But I think to more concisely answer the question, I think the intention was to, like, really try to, like, honor the best of what people said in the interviews and find a way for them, for, like, the pieces to fit together. And that wasn't immediately clear, and it took listening to things over and over again to sort of hear how it worked together.
The interesting part about my research into this monument was that everything about it was exactly as I saw it, except in my dream the woman was brown. It's a bronze statue. So if my grandmother visited, it would make sense that she would remember the statue as brown before it oxidized. She probably would have visited it in the 50s. So I think very much that there were a lot of things that she wanted to say to me.
In the video, I noticed there's different art styles shown. Like, sometimes there's a lot of geometric, sometimes there's earthy tone colors, and sometimes there's neon ones. How did you choose all the different art styles and color palettes?
I have no idea. Yeah. No, I wish I knew. I definitely end up painting bright, or doing stuff with bright colors. I'm not sure why. I love them. That's probably why. Yeah, I think the color palettes, it comes from just what I liked. And then probably the reason you were seeing some more geometric stuff is I figured out some various programs I could use that would take a animation I'd made and turn it into a kaleidoscope, and I could mess around with that. So I was doing a lot of feeding animations back through different programs and then feeding it again and feeding it again. So it would morph different things. Yeah. I don't do a lot of planning, and I don't think my stuff would be as good if I was trying to plan it. At least in my experience, anytime I've tried to plan something artistically, it kind of falls on its face. But if I feel it, then it looks how it should look. Also, it's easier. Yeah.
Have you two been in there alone by yourselves?
I don't think I've actually ever – I haven't spent much time in there alone because I've gone – my daughter often comes with me just because I've had a series of, like, childcare mishaps where she ends up coming. Yeah, that's weird. I popped in there for a second today by myself, so maybe that counts. But no, usually have a tag along.
I've been in there alone. Yeah, this is such an interesting question. Would you say a little bit more about your thinking behind this question?
Yeah, I spent around 45 minutes in there. I feel like I responded to it in a particular way, and certain emotions came up for me. What emotions come up when you're in the installation space?
I think what feels true for me to say, and what also maybe feels like vulnerable to say, is, yeah, I had an experience in there listening, and the way the piece begins and the way the piece ends, there's two images. There's an image in the first dream about someone on a porch with a bathtub, like, and there's a bathtub, and there's like a, they're trying to get in a door, and there's someone there, but then it, like, well, yeah, but there's like this sense of like the way I imagine it, like the space is pretty, I don't know, it's got this like eerie quality. And the final dream that is in the piece is about like a space that a person dreamed about many times. And the way she describes the space is like the colors changed, the textures would change, but she always recognized it. And it always had a particular feeling, like a big space that's empty. But there should be people in it, like almost like an auditorium. You feel that silence. And I think when I've been in there and I've listened on my own, I think what has come up for me is that sense of like, I don't know, like I hear all the people who contributed, and there were so many people in our community and our friend group who shared stories or shared music, put in a lot of time, listened, helped us process, taught us things. And in that way, it really feels like a piece that like came out of community that like doesn't just belong to us, but like comes from a lot of people who are so dear to me. And I think the sense of their presence in the space and the emptiness of that room, being in there on my own, and feeling like that sense of impermanence is very emotional for me, because there was so much love and heart that went into the making and so much generosity. And it's a really good moment to be here and to be with people. And a part of me just like wants to hold on to that and, you know, recognizes that it's all going to be very dreamlike. You know, it already is dreamlike. So I think that's what comes up for me when I'm in the space on my own. Yeah, it's so different for everyone.
You know, we don't talk about loss that much as just in daily life. And so there have been a number of people who have brought up loss as a way of talking about the show or as part of talking about the show. So I appreciate, and I'm really glad that the show has created some sort of a space where people can think about that and feel it. I have kind of a hard time being in there, I think, because I'm trying to buy my own stuff, so it's like a little bit hard to get past my own critic about myself. Because I'll see like glitch in an animation and I'm like, oh God, like why didn't I catch that before it went live? Or, you know, I'm still have to work through that. So maybe I kind of wish I didn't, but that unfortunately is the case. I will say the opening night was packed because Aaron is very popular.
It's not true.
It is? No.
We had a lot of people show up.
So many friends. I had like 3 friends. He was like 50 friends. No, it was packed. And so I went into the room and, you know, nobody knows I'm the artist, which is great. And it was like you couldn't stand. There were people just sitting and they were so engaged. And I did feel this real sense of awe. And I think being able to be anonymous allowed me to feel that. And it felt really, really, I don't even have a good word for it, but it felt really important. And it felt like, I don't make art for other people, but it felt like, oh, cool, like something I've made is actually useful to someone. Because it's not always the intention, right? It's just something that sort of happens compulsively. So it felt neat that the thing that I do compulsively was appreciated.
Dream Motif by Aaron Slumsky-Pritz and Jenny Lesser-Holman was created through the Jack Straw New Media Gallery Residency Program. Podcast interviewer and producer is Carlos Nieto. Engineers are Daniel Gunther and Ayesha Ubiadelica. The Jack Straw Residency Programs are made possible with support from the Seattle Office of Arts and Culture, For Culture, Washington State Arts Commission, the U District Partnership, National Endowment for the Arts, Rainier Institute and Foundation, Arts Fund, and individual contributors. To learn more about our arts programs and hear more podcasts, visit us at jackstraw.org.